Ashenden, W. Somerset Maugham. Chapter 12. His Excellency. Ashenden looked forward with misgiving to the dinner to which Sir Herbert Witherspoon had invited him. The black tie suggested a small party, perhaps only Lady Anne, the ambassador's wife, whom Ashenden didn't know, or one or two young secretaries. It did not presage a hilarious evening. It was possible that they might play bridge after dinner, but Ashenden knew that professional diplomats do not play bridge with skill. It may be supposed that they find it difficult to bend their great minds to the triviality of a parlor game. On the other hand, he was interested to see a little more of the ambassador in circumstances of less formality, for it was evident that Sir Herbert Witherspoon was not an ordinary person. He was, in appearance and manner, a perfect specimen of his class, and it's always entertaining to come upon good examples of a well-known type. He was exactly what you expected an ambassador to be. If any of his characteristics had been ever so slightly exaggerated, he would have been a caricature. He escaped being ridiculous only by a hair's breadth, and you watched him with a kind of breathlessness, as you might watch a tightrope dancer doing perilous feats at a dizzy height. He was certainly a man of character. His rise in the diplomatic service had been rapid, and though doubtless it had helped him to be connected by marriage with powerful families, his rise had been due chiefly to his merit. He knew how to be determined when determination was necessary, and conciliatory when conciliation was opportune. His manners were perfect. He could speak half a dozen languages with ease and accuracy. He had a clear and logical brain. He was never afraid to think out his thoughts to the end, but was wise enough to suit his actions to the exigencies of the situation. He had reached his post at X at the early age of 53, and had borne himself in the exceedingly difficult conditions created by the war and contending parties within the state with tact, confidence, and once at least, with courage. For on one occasion, a riot having arisen, a band of revolutionaries forced their way into the British Embassy, and Sir Herbert, from the head of his stairs, had harangued them, and notwithstanding revolvers flourished at him, had persuaded them to go to their homes. He would end his career in Paris, that was evident. He was a man whom you could not but admire, but whom it was not easy to like. He was a diplomat of the school of those Victorian ambassadors to whom could confidently be entrusted great affairs and whose self-reliance, sometimes it must be admitted tinctured with arrogance, was justified by its results. When Ashenden drove up to the doors of the embassy, they were flung open, and he was received by a stout and dignified English butler and three footmen. He was ushered up that magnificent flight of stairs on which had taken place the dramatic incident just related, and shown into an immense room, dimly lit with shaded lamps, in which at the first glance he caught sight of large pieces of stately furniture, and over the chimney-piece an immense portrait in coronation robes of King George IV. But there was a bright fire blazing in the hearth, and from a deep sofa by the side of it, his host, as his name was announced, slowly rose. Sir Herbert looked very elegant as he came towards him. He wore his dinner jacket, the most difficult costume for a man to look well in, with incredible distinction. "My wife has gone to a concert, but she'll come in later. She wants to make your acquaintance. I haven't asked anybody else. I thought I'd give myself the pleasure of enjoying your company on tête-à-tête." Ashenden murmured a civil rejoinder, but his heart sank. He wondered how he was going to pass at least a couple of hours alone with this man, who made him, he was bound to confess, feel extremely shy. The door was opened again, and the butler and footman entered, bearing very heavy silver salvers. "I always have a glass of sherry before my dinner," said the ambassador, "but in case you've acquired the barbarous custom of drinking cocktails, I can offer you what I believe is called a dry martini." Shy though he might be, Ashenden was not going to give in to this sort of thing with complete lameness. "I move with the times," he replied. "To drink a glass of sherry when you can get a dry martini is like taking a stagecoach when you can travel by the Orient Express." A little desultory conversation after this fashion was interrupted by the throwing open of two great doors and the announcement that His Excellency's dinner was served. They went into the dining room. This was a vast apartment in which 60 people might have comfortably dined, but there was now only a small round table in it, so that Sir Herbert and Ashenden sat intimately. There was an immense mahogany sideboard on which were massive pieces of gold plate, and above it, facing Ashenden, was a fine picture of Canaletto. Over the chimneypiece was a three-quarter-length portrait of Queen Victoria as a girl with a little gold crown on her small, prim head. Dinner was served by the corpulent butler and the three very tall English footmen. Ashenden had the impression that the ambassador enjoyed in his well-bred way the sensation of ignoring the pomp in which he lived. They might have been dining in one of the great country houses in England. It was a ceremony they performed, sumptuous, without ostentation, and it was saved from a trifling absurdity only because it was in a tradition, but with the experience gained for Ashenden, a kind of savor from the thought that dwelt with him that on the other side of the wall was a restless, turbulent population that might at any moment break into bloody revolution, while not 200 miles away, men in the trenches were sheltering in their dugouts from the bitter cold and the pitiless bombardment. Ashenden need not have feared that the conversation would proceed with difficulty, and the notion he had had that Sir Herbert had asked him in order to question him about his secret mission was quickly dispelled. The ambassador behaved to him as though he were a traveling Englishman who had presented a letter of introduction and to whom he desired to show civility. You would hardly have thought that a war was raging, for he made to it only such references as showed that he was not deliberately avoiding a distressing subject. He spoke of art and literature, proving himself to be a diligent reader of Catholic taste, and when Ashenden talked to him, from personal acquaintance, of the writers whom Sir Herbert knew only through their works, he listened with the friendly condescension which great ones of the earth affect towards the artist. Sometimes, however, they paint a picture or write a book, and then the artist gets a little of his own back. He mentioned in passing a character in one of Ashenden's novels, but did not make any other reference to the fact that his guest was a writer. Ashenden admired his urbanity. He disliked people to talk to him of his books, in which, indeed, once written, he took small interest, and it made him self-conscious to be praised or blamed to his face. Sir Herbert Witherspoon flattered his self-esteem by showing that he had read him, but spared his delicacy by withholding his opinion of what he had read. He spoke, too, of the various countries in which, during his career, he'd been stationed and of various persons in London and elsewhere that he and Ashenden knew in common. He talked well, not without a pleasant irony that might very well have passed for humor, and intelligently. Ashenden did not find his dinner dull, but neither did he find it exhilarating. He would have been more interested if the ambassador had not so invariably said the right, wise, and sensible thing upon every topic that was introduced. Ashenden was finding it something of an effort to keep up with this distinction of mind, and he would have liked the conversation to get into its shirt sleeves, so to speak, and put its feet on the table. But of this there was no chance, and Ashenden once or twice caught himself wondering how soon he could decently take his leave. At 11, he had an appointment with Herbartus at the Hôtel de Paris. The dinner came to an end, and coffee was brought in. Sir Herbert knew good food and good wine, and Ashenden was obliged to admit that he had fared excellently. Liqueurs were served with the coffee, and Ashenden took a glass of brandy. "I have some very old Benedictine," said the ambassador. "Won't you try it?" "To tell you the honest truth, I think brandy's the only liquor worth drinking." "I'm not sure that I don't agree with you, but in that case I must give you something better than that." He gave an order to the butler, who presently brought in a cobwebbed bottle and two enormous glasses. "I don't really want to boast," said the ambassador as he watched the butler pour the golden liquid into Ashenden's glass. "But I venture to think that if you like brandy, you'll like this. I got it when I was counselor for a short time in Paris. I've had a good deal to do lately with one of your successors, then."
"Byring?"
"Yes. What do you think of the brandy?"
"I think it's marvelous."
"And of Byring?"
The question came so oddly on the top of the other that it sounded faintly comic.
"Oh, I think he's a damn fool."
Sir Herbert leaned back in his chair, holding the huge glass with both hands in order to bring out the aroma, and looked slowly round the stately and spacious room. The table had been cleared of superfluous things. There was a bowl of roses between Ashenden and his host. The servant switched off the electric light as they finally left the room, and it was lit now only by the candles that were on the table and by the fire. Notwithstanding its size, it had an air of sober comfort. The ambassador's eyes rested on the really distinguished portrait of Queen Victoria that hung over the chimney-piece.
"I wonder," he said at last. "He'll have to leave the diplomatic service."
"I'm afraid so."
Ashenden gave him a quick glance of inquiry. He was the last man from whom he would have expected sympathy for Byring.
"Yes, in the circumstances," he proceeded, "I suppose it's inevitable that he should leave the service. I'm sorry. He's an able fellow, and he'll be missed. I think he had a career before him."
"Yes, that's what I've heard. I'm told that at the FO they thought very highly of him.
He has many of the gifts that are useful in this rather dreary trade," said the ambassador, with a slight smile, in his cold and judicial manner. "He's handsome, he's a gentleman, he has nice manners, he speaks excellent French, and he has a good head on his shoulders. He'd have done well. It seems a pity that he should waste such golden opportunities. I understand he's going into the wine business at the end of the war. Oddly enough, he's going to represent the very firm from whom I got this brandy."
Sir Herbert raised the glass to his nose and inhaled the fragrance. Then he looked at Ashenden. He had a way of looking at people, when he was thinking of something else, perhaps, that suggested that he thought them somewhat peculiar, but rather disgusting insects.
"Have you ever seen the woman?" he asked.
"I dined with her in Byring at LaRue's."
"How very interesting. What's she like?"
"Charming."
Ashenden tried to describe her to his host, but meanwhile, with another part of his mind, he recollected the impression she had made on him at the restaurant when Byring had introduced him to her. He'd been not a little interested to meet a woman of whom for some years he'd heard so much. She called herself Rose Auburn, but what her real name was few knew. She had gone to Paris originally as one of a troupe of dancers called the Glad Girls, who performed at the Moulin Rouge. But her astonishing beauty had soon caused her to be noticed, and a wealthy French manufacturer fell in love with her. He gave her a house and loaded her with jewels, but could not long meet the demands she made upon him, and she passed in rapid succession from lover to lover. She became in a short time the best-known courtesan in France. Her expenditure was prodigal, and she ruined her admirers with cynical unconcern. The richest men found themselves unable to cope with her extravagance. Ashenden, before the war, had seen her once at Monte Carlo lose 180,000 francs at a sitting, and that then was an important sum. She sat at the big table, throwing down packets of 1,000-franc notes with a self-possession that would have been admirable if it had been her own money that she was losing. When Ashenden met her, she had been leading this riotous life, dancing and gambling all night, racing most afternoons a week, for 12 or 13 years, and she was no longer very young. But there was hardly a line on that lovely brow, scarcely a crow's foot around those liquid eyes, to betray the fact. The most astonishing thing about her was that notwithstanding this feverish and unending rout of senseless debauchery, she had preserved an air of virginity. Of course she cultivated the type. She had an exquisitely graceful and slender figure, and her innumerable frocks were always made with a perfect simplicity. Her brown hair was very plainly done. With her oval face, charming little nose, and large blue eyes, she had all the air of one or other of Anthony Trollope's charming heroines. It was the keepsake style raised to such rareness that it made you catch your breath. She had a lovely skin, very white and red, and if she painted, it was not from necessity but from wantonness. She irradiated a sort of dewy innocence that was as attractive as it was unexpected. Ashenden had heard, of course, that Byring for a year or more had been her lover. Her notoriety was such that a hard light of publicity was shed on everyone with whom she had any affair. But in this instance, the gossips had more to say than usual, because Byring had no money to speak of, and Rose Auburn had never known to grant her favors for anything that did not in some way represent hard cash. Was it possible that she loved him? It seemed incredible, and yet what other explanation was there? Byring was a young man with whom any woman might have fallen in love. He was somewhere in the 30s, very tall and good-looking, with a singular charm of manner, and of an appearance so debonair that people turned round in the street to look at him. But unlike most handsome men, he seemed entirely unaware of the impression he created. When it became known that Byring was the amant du coeur, a prettier phrase than our English fancy man, of this famous harlot, he became an object of admiration to many women and of envy to many men. But when a rumor spread abroad that he was going to marry her, consternation seized his friends and ribald laughter everyone else. It became known that Byring's chief had asked him if it was true, and he had admitted it. Pressure was put upon him to relinquish a plan that could only end in disaster. It was pointed out to him that the wife of a diplomat has social obligations that Rose Auburn could not fulfill. Byring replied that he was prepared to resign his post whenever by so doing he would not cause inconvenience. He brushed aside every expostulation and every argument. He was determined to marry. When first Ashenden met Byring, he did not very much take to him. He found him slightly aloof. But as the hazards of his work brought him from time to time into contact with him, he discerned that the distant manner was due merely to shyness, and as he came to know him better, he was charmed by the uncommon sweetness of his disposition. Their relations, however, remained purely official, so that it was a trifle unexpected when Byring one day asked him to dinner to meet Miss Auburn, and he could not but wonder whether it was because already people were beginning to turn the cold shoulder on him. When he went, he discovered that the invitation was due to the lady's curiosity. But the surprise he got on learning that she had found time to read, with admiration it appeared, two or three of his novels, was not the only surprise he got that evening. Leading on the whole a quiet and studious life, he had never had occasion to penetrate into the world of the higher prostitution, and the great courtesans of the period were known to him only by name. It was somewhat astonishing to Ashenden to discover that Rose Auburn differed so little in air and manner from the smart women of Mayfair, with whom, through his books, he had become more or less intimately acquainted. She was perhaps a little more anxious to please. Indeed, one of her agreeable traits was the interest she took in whomever she was talking to. But she was certainly no more made up, and her conversation was as intelligent. It lacked only the coarseness that society has lately affected. Perhaps she felt instinctively that those lovely lips should never disfigure themselves with foul words. Perhaps only she was at heart still a trifle suburban. It was evident that she and Byring were madly in love with one another. It was really moving to see their mutual passion. When Ashenden took his leave of them, as he shook hands with her, and she held his hand a moment and with her blue starry eyes looked into his, she said to him, "You will come and see us when we're settled in London, won't you? You know we're going to be married." "I heartily congratulate you," said Ashenden. "And him?" She smiled. And her smile was like an angel's. It had the freshness of dawn and the tender rapture of a southern spring. "Have you never looked at yourself in the glass?" Sir Herbert Witherspoon watched him intently, while Ashenden, he thought not without a trace of humor, described the dinner party. No flicker of a smile brightened his cold eyes.
"Do you think it'll be a success?" he asked now.
"No."
"Why not?"
The question took Ashenden back. "A man not only marries his wife, he marries her friends. Do you realize the sort of people Byring will have to mix with? Painted women of tarnished reputation and men who've gone down in the social scale, parasites and adventurers? Of course they'll have money. Her pearls must be worth £100,000, and they'll be able to cut a dash in the smart bohemia of London. Do you know the gold fringe of society? When a woman of bad character marries, she earns the admiration of her set. She has worked the trick. She's caught a man and become respectable. But he, the man, only earns its ridicule. Even her own friends, the old hags with their gigolos and the abject men who earn a shabby living by introducing the unwary to tradesmen on a 10% commission, even they despise him. He's the mug. Believe me, to conduct yourself gracefully in such a position, you need either great dignity of character or an unparalleled effrontery. Besides, do you think there's a chance of its lasting? Can a woman who's led that wild career settle down to domestic life? In a little while she'll grow bored and restless. And how long does love last? Don't you think Byring's reflections will be bitter when, caring for her no longer, he compares what he's with what he might have been?" Witherspoon helped himself to another drop of his old brandy. Then he looked up at Ashenden with a curious expression. "I'm not sure if a man isn't wiser to do what he wants very much to do and let the consequences take care of themselves." "It must be very pleasant to be an ambassador," said Ashenden. Sir Herbert smiled thinly. "Byring rather reminds me of a fellow I knew when I was a very junior clerk at the F.O. I won't tell you his name because he's by way of being very well known now and highly respected. He's made a great success of his career. There's always something a little absurd in success." Ashenden slightly raised his eyebrows at this statement, somewhat unexpected in the mouth of Sir Herbert Witherspoon, but did not say anything. "He was one of my fellow clerks. He was a brilliant creature. I don't think anyone ever denied that. And everyone prophesied from the beginning that he'd go far. I venture to say that he had pretty well all the qualifications necessary for a diplomatic career. He was of a family of soldiers and sailors, nothing very grand, but eminently respectable, and he knew how to behave in the great world without bumptiousness or timidity. He was well-read. He took an interest in painting. I dare say he made himself a trifle ridiculous. He wanted to be in the movement. He was very anxious to be modern. And at a time when little was known of Gauguin or Cézanne, he raved over their pictures. There was perhaps a certain snobbishness in his attitude, a desire to shock and astonish the conventional. But at heart, his admiration of the arts was genuine and sincere. He adored Paris, and whenever he had the chance, ran over and put up at a little hotel in the Latin Quarter, where he could rub shoulders with painters and writers. As is the habit with gentry of that sort, they patronized him a little because he was nothing but a diplomat, and laughed at him a little because he was evidently a gentleman. But they liked him because he was always ready to listen to their speeches, and when he praised their works, they were even willing to admit that, though a Philistine, he had a certain instinct for the right stuff." Ashenden noted the sarcasm and smiled at the fling at his own profession. He wondered what this long description was leading to. The ambassador seemed to linger over it, partly because he liked it, but also because, for some reason, he hesitated to come to the point. "But my friend was modest. He enjoyed himself enormously, and he listened open-mouthed when these young painters and unknown scribblers tore to pieces established reputations and talked with enthusiasm of persons of whom the sober but cultured secretaries in Downing Street had never even heard. At the back of his mind, he knew that they were rather a common, second-rate lot, and when he went back to his work in London, it was with no regret, but with the feeling that he'd been witnessing an odd and diverting play. Now the curtain had fallen, he was quite ready to go home. I haven't told you that he was ambitious. He knew that his friends expected him to do considerable things, and he had no notion of disappointing them. He was perfectly conscious of his abilities. He meant to succeed. Unfortunately, he was not rich. He had only a few hundreds a year, but his father and mother were dead, and he had neither brother nor sister. He was aware that this freedom from close ties was an asset. His opportunity to make connections that would be of use to him was unrestricted. Do you think he sounds a very disagreeable young man?
No, said Ashenden, in answer to the sudden question. Most clever young men are aware of their cleverness, and there's generally a certain cynicism in their calculations with regard to the future. Surely young men should be ambitious.
Well, on one of those little trips to Paris, my friend became acquainted with a talented young Irish painter called O'Malley. He's an R.A. now, and paints highly paid portraits of Lord Chancellors and Cabinet Ministers. I wonder if you remember one he did of my wife, which was exhibited a couple of years ago.
No, I don't, but I know his name.
My wife was delighted with it. His art always seems to me very refined and agreeable. He's able to put on canvas the distinction of his sitters in a very remarkable way. When he paints a woman of breeding, you know that it is a woman of breeding and not a trollop.
It is a charming gift, said Ashenden.
Can he also paint a slut and make her look like one?
He could. No, doubtless he would scarcely wish to. He was living then in a small and dirty studio in the Rue du Cherche Midi with a little Frenchwoman of the character you describe, and he painted several portraits of her, which were extremely like.
It seemed to Ashenden that Sir Herbert was going into somewhat excessive detail, and he asked himself whether the friend of whom he was telling a story that till now seemed to lead no whither was in point of fact himself. He began to give it more of his attention. My friend liked O'Malley. He was good company, the type of the agreeable rattle, and he had a truly Irish gift of the gab. He talked incessantly and, in my mind's opinion, brilliantly. He found it very amusing to go and sit in the studio while O'Malley was painting and listen to him chattering away about the technique of his art. O'Malley was always saying that he would paint a portrait of him, and his vanity was tickled. O'Malley thought him far from plain and said it would do him good to exhibit the portrait of someone who at least looked like a gentleman. By the way, when was all this? Asked Ashenden.
Oh, 30 years ago.
They used to talk of their future, and when O'Malley said the portrait he was going to paint of my friend would look very well in the National Portrait Gallery, my friend had small doubt in the back of his mind, whatever he modestly said, that it would eventually find its way there. One evening, when my friend, shall we call him Brown, was sitting in the studio and O'Malley, desperately taking advantage of the last light of day, was trying to get finished for the salon that portrait of his mistress, which is now in the Tate Gallery, O'Malley asked him if he would like to come and dine with him. He was expecting a friend of hers. She was called Yvonne, by the way, and he would be glad if Brown would make a fourth. This friend of Yvonne's was an acrobat, and O'Malley was anxious to get her to pose for him in the nude. Yvonne said she had a marvelous figure. She had seen O'Malley's work and was willing enough to sit, and dinner was to be devoted to settling the matter. She was not performing then, but she was about to open at the Gaiety Montparnasse, and with her days free, was not disinclined to oblige a friend and earn a little money. The notion amused Brown, who had never met an acrobat, and he accepted. Yvonne suggested that he might find her to his taste, and if he did, she could promise him that he would not find her very difficult to persuade. With his grand air and English clothes, she would take him for a milord anglais. My friend laughed. He did not take the suggestion very seriously. On ne sait jamais, he said. Yvonne looked at him with mischievous eyes. He sat on. It was Easter time and cold, but the studio was comfortably warm, and though it was small and everything was higgledy-piggledy and the dust lay heavy on the rim of the window, it was most friendly and cozy. Brown had a tiny flat in Waverton Street in London, with very good mezzo tints on the walls and several pieces of early Chinese pottery here and there, and he wondered to himself why his tasteful sitting room had none of the comforts of home nor the romance that he found in that disorderly studio. Presently, there was a ring at the door, and Yvonne ushered in her friend. Her name, it appeared, was Alex, and she shook hands with Brown, uttering a stereotyped phrase with the mincing politeness of a fat woman in a bureau de tabac. She wore a long cloak in imitation mink and an enormous scarlet hat. She looked incredibly vulgar. She was not even pretty. She had a broad, flat face, a wide mouth, and an upturned nose. She had a great deal of hair, golden, but obviously dyed, and large china blue eyes. She was heavily made up. Ashenden began to have no doubt that Witherspoon was narrating an experience of his own, for otherwise he could never have remembered after 30 years what hat the young woman wore and what coat, and he was amused at the ambassador's simplicity in thinking that so thin a subterfuge could disguise the truth. Ashenden could not but guess how the story would end, and it tickled him to think that this cold, distinguished, and exquisite person should ever have had anything like an adventure. She began to talk away to Yvonne, and my friend noticed that she had one feature that, oddly enough, he found very attractive. She had a deep and husky voice, as though she were just recovering from a bad cold, and he didn't know why. It seemed to him exceedingly pleasant to listen to. He asked O'Malley if that was her natural voice, and O'Malley said that she had it as long as he'd ever known her. He called it a whiskey voice. He told her what Brown said about it, and she gave him a smile of her wide mouth and said it wasn't due to drink, it was due to standing so much on her head. That was one of the inconveniences of her profession. Then the four of them went to a beastly little restaurant off the Boulevard Saint-Michel, where for 2.50 francs, including wine, my friend ate a dinner that seemed to him more delicious than any he had ever eaten at the Savoy or Claridge's. Alex was a very chatty young person, and Brown listened with amusement, with amazement even, while in her rich, throaty voice she talked of the varied incidents of the day. She had a great command of slang, and though he could not understand half of it, he was immensely tickled with its picturesque vulgarity. It was pungent of the heated asphalt, the zinc bars of cheap taverns, and the racy of the crowded squares in the poorer districts of Paris. There was an energy in those apt and vivid metaphors that went like champagne to his anemic head. She was a gutter snipe, yes, that's what she was. But she had a vitality that warmed you like a blazing fire. He was conscious that Yvonne had told her that he was an unattached Englishman with plenty of money. He saw the appraising glance that she gave him, and then, pretending that he had not noticed, he caught the phrase, "Il n'est pas mal." It faintly amused him. He had a notion himself that he was not so bad. There were places, indeed, where they went further than that. She did not pay much attention to him. In point of fact, they were talking of things of which he was ignorant, and he could do little more than show an intelligent interest. But now and again she gave him a long look, passing her tongue quickly round her lips, that suggested to him that he only had to ask for her to give. He shrugged a mental shoulder. She looked healthy and young. She had an agreeable vivacity, but beyond her husky voice there was nothing particularly attractive in her. But the notion of having a little affair in Paris did not displease him. It was life, and the thought that she was a music hall artiste was mildly diverting. In middle age, it would doubtless amuse him to remember that he had enjoyed the favors of an acrobat. Was it La Rochefoucauld or Oscar Wilde who said that you should commit errors in youth in order to have something to regret in old age? At the end of dinner, and they sat over their coffee and brandy till late, they went out into the street, and Yvonne proposed that he should take Alex home. He said he would be delighted. Alex said it was not far, and they walked. She told him that she had a little apartment. Of course, mostly she was on tour, but she liked to have a place of her own. A woman, you know, had to be in her furniture, Without that, she received no consideration. And presently they reached a shabby house in a bedraggled street. She rang the bell for the concierge to open the door. She did not press him to enter. He did not know if she looked upon it as a matter of course. He was seized with timidity. He racked his brains, but could not think of a single thing to say. Silence fell upon them. It was absurd. With a little click, the door opened. She looked at him expectantly. She was puzzled. A wave of shyness swept over him. Then she held out her hand, thanked him for bringing her to the door, and bade him good night. His heart beat nervously. If she had asked him to come in, he would have gone. He wanted some sign that she would like him to. He shook her hand, said good night, raised his hat, and walked away. He felt a perfect fool. He could not sleep. He tossed from side to side of his bed, thinking for what a noodle she must take him, and he could hardly wait for the day that would permit him to take steps to efface the contemptible impression he must have made on her. His pride was lacerated. Wanting to lose no time, he went round to her house at 11 to ask her to lunch with him, but she was out. He sent round some flowers and later in the day called again. She had been in, but was gone out once more. He went to see O'Malley on the chance of finding her, but she was not there. And O'Malley facetiously asked him how he'd fared. To save his face, he told him that he'd come to the conclusion that she did not mean very much to him, and so like a perfect gentleman, he had left her. But he had an uneasy feeling that O'Malley saw through this story. He sent her a pneumatic, asking her to dine with him next day. She didn't answer. He could not understand it. He asked the porter of his hotel a dozen times if there was nothing for him, and at last, almost in desperation, just before dinner, went to her house. The concierge told him she was in, and he went up. He was very nervous, inclined to be angry because she had treated his invitation so cavalierly, but at the same time anxious to appear at his ease. He climbed the four flights of stairs, dark and smelly, and rang at the door to which he had been directed. There was a pause. He heard sounds within and rang again. Presently she opened. He had an absolute certitude that she did not in the least know who he was. He was taken aback. It was a blow to his vanity, but he assumed a cheerful smile. "I came to find out if you were going to dine with me tonight. I sent you a pneumatic." Then she recognized him. But she stood at the door and did not ask him in. "Oh, no, I can't dine with you tonight. I have a terrible maigrime, and I'm going to bed. I couldn't answer your pneumatic. I mislaid it, and I'd forgotten your name. Thank you for the flowers. It was nice of you to send them." "Then won't you come and dine with me tomorrow night?" "Justement, I have an engagement tomorrow night. I'm sorry." There was nothing more to say. He had not the nerve to ask her to anything else, and so bade her good night and went. He had the impression that she was not vexed with him, but that she had entirely forgotten him. It was humiliating. When he went back to London without having seen her again, it was with a curious sense of dissatisfaction. He was not in the least in love with her. He was annoyed with her, but he could not get her quite out of his mind. He was honest enough to realize that he was suffering from nothing more than wounded vanity. During that dinner at the little restaurant off the Boul' Miche', she'd mentioned that her troupe was going to London in the spring, and in one of his letters to O'Malley, he slipped in casually a phrase to the effect that if his young friend Alex happened to be coming to town, he, O'Malley, might let him know and he would look her up. He would like to hear from her own ingenious lips what she thought of the nude O'Malley had painted of her. When the painter, sometime afterwards, wrote and told him that she was appearing a week later at the Metropolitan in Edgware Road, he felt a sudden rush of blood to his head. He went to see her play. If he had not taken the precaution to go earlier in the day and look at the program, he would have missed her, for her turn was the first on the list. There were two men, a stout one and a thin one, with large black mustaches, and Alex. They were dressed in ill-fitting pink tights with green satin trunks. The men did various exercises on twin trapezes, while Alex tripped about the stage, giving them handkerchiefs to wipe their hands on, and occasionally turned a somersault. When the fat man raised the thin one on his shoulders, she climbed up and stood on the shoulders of the second, kissing her hand to the audience. They did tricks with safety bicycles. There is often grace and even beauty in the performance of clever acrobats, but this one was so crude, so vulgar, that my friend felt positively embarrassed. There's something shameful in seeing grown men publicly make fools of themselves. Poor Alex, with a fixed and artificial smile on her lips, in her pink tights and green satin trunks, was so grotesque that he wondered how he could have let himself feel a moment's annoyance because when he went to her apartment she had not recognized him. It was with a shrug of the shoulders, condescendingly, that he went round to the stage door afterwards and gave the doorkeeper a shilling to take her his card. In a few minutes she came out. She seemed delighted to see him. "Oh, how good it is to see the face of someone you know in this sad city," she said. "Ah, now you can give me that dinner you asked me to go in Paris. I'm dying of hunger. I never eat before the show. Imagine that they should have given us such a bad place on the program. It's an insult. But we shall see the agent tomorrow. If they think they can put upon us like that, they're mistaken. Ah, no, no, no. And what an audience. No enthusiasm, no applause, nothing." My friend was staggered. Was it possible that she took her performance seriously? He almost burst out laughing, but she still spoke with that throaty voice that had such a queer effect on his nerves. She was dressed all in red and wore the same red hat in which he had first seen her. She looked so flashy that he didn't fancy the notion of asking her to a place where he might be seen, and so suggested Soho. There were Hansons still in those days, and the hansom was more conducive to lovemaking, I imagine, than is the taxi of the present time. My friend put his arm around Alex's waist and kissed her. It left her calm, but on the other hand, did not wildly excite him. While they ate a late dinner, he made himself very gallant, and she played up to him agreeably. But when they'd got up to go, and he proposed that she should come round to his rooms in Waverton Street, she told him that a friend had come over from Paris with her, and that she had to meet him at 11. She had only been able to dine with Brown because her companion had a business engagement. Brown was exasperated, but did not want to show it. And when, as they walked down Wardour Street, for she had said she wanted to go to the Café Monico, pausing in front of a pawnbroker to look in at the jewelry in the window, she went into ecstasies over a bracelet of sapphires and diamonds that Brown thought incredibly vulgar, he asked her if she would like it. "But it's marked £15, she said. He went in and bought it for her. She was delighted. She made him leave her just before they came to Piccadilly Circus. "Now listen, mon petit," she said. "I cannot see you in London because of my friend. He is jealous as a wolf. That is why I think it is more prudent for you to go now. But I'm playing at Bologna next week. Why not you come over for that? I shall be alone there. My friend has to go back to Holland where he lives." "All right," said Brown. "I'll come." When he went to Bologna, he had 2 days' leave. It was with the one idea of salving the wound to his pride. It was odd that he should care. I dare say to you it seems inexplicable. He could not bear the notion that Alex looked upon him as a fool, and he felt that when once he had removed that impression from her, he would never bother about her again. He thought of O'Malley, too, and of Yvonne. She must have told him, and it galled him, to think that people whom in his heart he despised should laugh at him behind his back. Do you think he was very contemptible? Good gracious, no, said Ashenden. All sensible people know that vanity is the most devastating, the most universal, and the most ineradicable of the passions that afflict the soul of man, and it's only vanity that makes him deny its power. It's more consuming than love. With advancing years, mercifully, you snap your fingers at the terror and the servitude of love, but age cannot free you from the thraldom of vanity. Time can assuage the pangs of love, but only death can still the anguish of wounded vanity. Love is simple and seeks no subterfuge, but vanity cozens you with 100 disguises. It's part and parcel of every virtue.
It's the mainspring of courage and the strength of ambition. It gives constancy to the lover and endurance to the stoic. It adds fuel to the fire of the artist's desire for fame and is at once the support and the compensation of the honest man's integrity. It leers even cynically in the humility of the saint. You cannot escape it, and you should take pains to guard against it. It will make use of those very pains to trip you up. You are defenseless against its onslaught because you know not on what unprotected side it will attack you. Sincerity cannot protect you from its snare, nor humor from its mockery. Ashington stopped, not because he had said all he had to say, but because he was out of breath. He noticed also that the ambassador, desiring to talk rather than to listen, heard him with a politeness that was strained. But he had made this speech not so much for his host's edification as for his own entertainment. It is vanity, finally, that makes man support his abominable lot. For a minute, Sir Herbert was silent. He looked straight in front of him as though his thoughts lingered distressfully on some far horizon of memory. When my friend came back from Bologna, he knew that he was madly in love with Alex, and he had arranged to meet her again in a fortnight's time when she would be performing at Dunkirk. He thought of nothing else in this interval, and the night before he was to start, he had only 36 hours this time. He couldn't sleep, so devouring was the passion that consumed him. Then he went over for a night to Paris to see her, and once when she was disengaged for a week, he persuaded her to come to London. He knew that she did not love him. He was just a man among a hundred others, and she made no secret of the fact that he was not her only lover. He suffered agonies of jealousy, but knew that it would only excite her ridicule or her anger if he showed it. She had not even a fancy for him. She liked him because he was a gentleman and well-dressed. She was quite willing to be his mistress so long as the claims he made on her were not irksome. But that was all. His means were not large enough to enable him to make her any serious offers, but even if they had been, liking her freedom, she would have refused. "But what about the Dutchman?" asked Ashenden. "The Dutchman? He was a pure invention. She made him up on the spur of the moment because, for one reason or another, she did not just then want to be bothered with Brown. What should one lie more or less matter to her? Don't think he didn't struggle against his passion. He knew it was madness. He knew that a permanent connection between them could only lead to disaster for him. He had no illusions about her. She was common, coarse, and vulgar. She could talk of none of the things that interested him, nor did she try. She took it for granted that he was concerned with her affairs and told him interminable stories of her quarrels with fellow performers, her disputes with managers, and her wrangles with hotel keepers. What she said bored him to death, but the sound of her throaty voice made his heart beat so that sometimes he thought he would suffocate." Ashenden sat uneasily in his chair. It was a Sheraton chair, very good to look at, but hard and straight. And he wished that Sir Herbert had had the notion of going back to the other room where there was a comfortable sofa. It was quite plain now that the story he was telling was about himself, and Ashenden felt a certain indelicacy in the man's stripping his soul before him so nakedly. He did not desire this confidence to be forced upon him. Sir Herbert Witherspoon meant nothing to him. By the light of the shaded candles, Ashenden saw that he was deathly pale, and there was a wildness in his eyes that in that cold and composed man was strangely disconcerting. He poured himself out a glass of water. His throat was so dry that he could hardly speak. But he went on pitilessly. "At last, my friend managed to pull himself together. He was disgusted by the sordidness of his intrigue. There was no beauty in it, nothing but shame, and it was leading to nothing. His passion was as vulgar as the woman for whom he felt it. Now it happened that Alex was going to spend 6 months in the north of Africa with her troop, and for that time at least it would be impossible for him to see her. He made up his mind that he must seize the opportunity and make a definite break. He knew bitterly that it would mean nothing to her. In 3 weeks she would have forgotten him. And then there was something else. He had come to know very well some people, a man and his wife, whose social and political connections were extremely important.
They had an only daughter, and I don't know why she fell in love with him. She was everything that Alex was not. Pretty, in the real English way, with blue eyes and pink and white cheeks, tall and fair. She might have stepped out of one of Du Maurier's pictures in Punch. She was clever and well-read, and since she'd lived all her life in political circles, she could talk intelligently of the sort of things that interested him. He had reason to believe that if he asked her to marry him, she would accept. I've told you that he was ambitious. He knew that he had great abilities and he wanted the chance to use them. She was related to some of the greatest families in England, and he would have been a fool not to realize that a marriage of this kind must make his path infinitely easier. The opportunity was golden. And what a relief to think that he could put behind him definitely that ugly little episode, and what a happiness, instead of that wall of cheerful indifference and matter-of-fact good nature against which in his passion for Alex he'd vainly battered his head, what a happiness to feel that to someone else he really meant something. How could he help being flattered and touched when he saw her face light up as he came into the room? He wasn't in love with her, but he thought her charming, and he wanted to forget Alex and the vulgar life into which she had led him. At last, he made up his mind. He asked her to marry him and was accepted. Her family was delighted. The marriage was to take place in the autumn, since her father had to go on some political errand to South America and was taking his wife and daughter with him. They were to be gone the whole summer. My friend Brown was transferring from the FO to the diplomatic service and had been promised a post at Lisbon. He was to go there immediately. He saw his fiancée off. Then it happened that, owing to some hitch, the man whom Brown was going to replace was kept at Lisbon 3 months longer, and so for that period my friend found himself at a loose end. And just when he was making up his mind what to do with himself, he received a letter from Alex. She was coming back to France and had a tour booked. She gave him a long list of the places she was going to, and in her casual, friendly way, said that they would have fun if he could manage to run over for a day or two. An insane, a criminal notion seized him. If she had shown any eagerness for him to come, he might have resisted. It was her airy, matter-of-fact indifference that took him. On a sudden, he longed for her. He did not care if she was gross and vulgar. He had got her in his bones, and it was his last chance. In a little while, he was going to be married. It was now or never. He went down to Marseille and met her as she stepped off the boat that had brought her from Tunis. His heart leaped at the pleasure she showed on seeing him. He knew he loved her madly. He told her that he was going to be married in 3 months and asked her to spend the last of his freedom with him. She refused to abandon her tour. How could she leave her companions in the lurch? He offered to compensate them, but she would not hear of it. They could not find someone to take her place at a moment's notice, nor could they afford to throw over a good engagement that might lead to others in the future. They were honest people, and they kept their word, and they had their duty to their managers and their public. He was exasperated. It seemed absurd that his whole happiness should be sacrificed to that wretched tour, and at the end of the 3 months, what was to happen to her then? Oh no, he was asking something that wasn't reasonable. He told her that he adored her. He did not know till then how insanely he loved her. Well then, she said, why not he come with her and make the tour with them? She would be glad for his company. They could have a good time together, and at the end of 3 months he could go and marry his heiress, and neither of them would be any the worse. For a moment he hesitated. But now that he saw her again, he could not bear the thought of being parted from her so soon. He accepted. And then she said, but listen, my little one, you mustn't be silly, you know. The managers won't be too pleased with me if I make a lot of shishi. I have to think of my future, and they won't be so anxious to have me back if I refuse to please old customers of the house. It won't be very often, but it must be understood that you are not to make me scenes if now and then I give myself to someone whose fancy I take. It will mean nothing. That is business. You will be my amant de coeur. He felt a strange, excruciating pain in his heart, and I think he went so pale that she thought he was going to faint. She looked at him curiously. Those are the terms, she said. You can either take them or leave them. He accepted. Sir Herbert Witherspoon leaned forward in his chair, and he was so white that Ashenden thought, too, that he was going to faint. His skin was drawn over his skull so that his face looked like a death's head, but the veins in his forehead stood out like knotted cords. He had lost all reticence. And Ashenden once more wished that he would stop. It made him shy and nervous to see the man's naked soul. No one has the right to show himself to another in that destitute state. He was inclined to cry. "Stop, stop, you mustn't tell me any more. You'll be so ashamed." But the man had lost all shame. For 3 months, they traveled together from one dull provincial town to another, sharing a filthy little bedroom in frowsy hotels. Alex would not let him take her to good hotels. She said she had not the clothes for them, and she was more comfortable in the sort of hotel she was used to. She did not want her companions in the business to say that she was putting on side. He sat interminable hours in shabby cafes. He was treated as a brother by members of the troop. They called him by his Christian name and chaffed him coarsely and slapped him on the back. He ran errands for them when they were busy with their work. He saw the good-humored contempt in the eyes of managers and was obliged to put up with the familiarity of stagehands. They traveled third class from place to place, and he helped to carry the luggage. He, with whom reading was a passion, never opened a book, because Alex was bored by reading and thought that anyone who did was just giving himself airs. Every night he went to the music hall and watched her go through that grotesque and ignoble performance. He had to fall in with her pathetic fancy that it was artistic. He had to congratulate her when it had gone well and condole with her when some feat of agility had gone amiss. When she'd finished, he went to a cafe and waited for her while she changed, and sometimes she would come in rather hurriedly and say, "Don't wait for me tonight, mon chou, I'm busy." And then he would undergo agonies of jealousy. He would suffer as he never knew a man could suffer. She would come back to the hotel at 3 or 4 in the morning. She wondered why he was not asleep. Sleep! How could he sleep with that misery gnawing at his heart? He had promised he would not interfere with her. He did not keep his promise. He made her terrific scenes. Sometimes he beat her. Then she would lose her patience and tell him she was sick of him. She would pack her things to go, and then he would go groveling to her, promising anything, any submission, vowing to swallow any humiliation if she would not leave him. It was horrible and degrading. He was miserable. Miserable? No. He was happier than he'd ever been in his life. It was the gutter that he wallowed in, but he wallowed in it with delight. Oh, he was so bored with the life he'd led hitherto, and this one seemed to him amazing and romantic. This was reality. And that frowsy, ugly woman with the whiskey voice, she had such a splendid vitality, such a zest for life, that she seemed to raise his own to some more vivid level. It really did seem to him to burn with a pure, gem-like flame. "Do people still read Potter?" "I don't know," said Ashenden. "I don't." There was only 3 months of it. Oh, how short the time seemed, and how quickly the week sped by. Sometimes he had wild dreams of abandoning everything and throwing in his lot with the acrobats. They had come to have quite a liking for him, and they said he could easily train himself to take a part in the turn. He knew they said it more in jest than in earnest, but the notion vaguely tickled him. But these were only dreams, and he knew that nothing would come of them. He never really chaffered with the thought that when the 3 months came to an end, he would not return to his own life with its obligations. With his mind, that cold, logical mind of his, he knew it would be absurd to sacrifice everything for a woman like Alex. He was ambitious. He wanted power. And besides, he could not break the heart of that poor child who loved and trusted him. She wrote to him once a week. She was longing to get back. The time seemed endless to her, and he had a secret wish that something would happen to delay her arrival. If he could only have a little more time. Perhaps if he had 6 months, he would have got over his infatuation. Already, sometimes, he hated Alex. The last day came. They seemed to have little to say to one another. They were both sad, but he knew that Alex only regretted the breaking of an agreeable habit. In 24 hours, she would be as gay and full of spirits with her stray companion as though he had never crossed her path. He could only think that next day he was going to Paris to meet his fiancée and her family. They spent their last night in one another's arms, weeping. If she'd asked him then not to leave her, it may be that he would have stayed. But she didn't. It never occurred to her. She accepted his going as a settled thing, and she wept not because she loved him. She wept because he was unhappy. In the morning, she was sleeping so soundly that he had not the heart to wake her, to say goodbye. He slipped out very quietly, with his bag in his hand, and took the train to Paris. Ashenden turned away his head, for he saw two tears form themselves in Witherspoon's eyes and roll down his cheeks. He did not even try to hide them. Ashenden lit another cigar. In Paris, they cried out when they saw him. They said he looked like a ghost. He told them he'd been ill and hadn't said anything about it in order not to worry them. They were very kind. A month later, he was married. He did very well for himself. He was given opportunities to distinguish himself, and he distinguished himself. His rise was spectacular. He had the well-ordered and distinguished establishment that he had wanted. He had the power for which he had craved. He was loaded with honors. Oh, he made a success of life, and there were hundreds who envied him. It was all ashes. He was bored, bored to distraction, bored by that distinguished, beautiful lady he had married, bored by the people his life forced him to live with. It was a comedy he was playing, and sometimes it seemed intolerable to live forever and ever behind a mask. Sometimes he felt he couldn't bear it, but he bore it. Sometimes he longed for Alex so fiercely that he felt it would be better to shoot himself than to suffer such anguish. He never saw her again, never. He heard from O'Malley that she had married and left her troop. She must be a fat old woman now, and it doesn't matter anymore. But he had wasted his life, and he never even made that poor creature whom he married happy. How could he go on hiding from her year after year that he had nothing to give her but pity? Once, in his agony, he told her about Alex, and she tortured him ever after with her jealousy. He knew that he should never have married her. In 6 months, she would have got over her grief if he had told her he could not bear to, and in the end would have happily married somebody else. So far as she was concerned, his sacrifice was vain. He was terribly conscious that he had only one life, and it seemed so sad to think that he had wasted it. He could never surmount his immeasurable regret. He laughed when people spoke of him as a strong man. He was as weak and unstable as water. And that's why I tell you that Byring is right. Even though it only lasts 5 years, even though he ruins his career, even though this marriage of his ends in disaster, it will have been worthwhile. He will have been satisfied. He will have fulfilled himself. At that moment, the door opened and a lady came in. The ambassador glanced at her, and for an instant a look of cold hatred crossed his face, but it was only for an instant. Then, rising from the table, he composed his ravaged features to an expression of courteous suavity. He gave the incomer a haggard smile. "Here's my wife. This is Mr. Ashenden." "I couldn't imagine where you were. Why didn't you go and sit in your study? I'm sure Mr. Ashenden's been dreadfully uncomfortable." She was a tall, thin woman of 50, rather drawn and faded, but she looked as though she had once been pretty. It was obvious that she was very well-bred. She vaguely reminded you of an exotic plant, reared in a hothouse, that had begun to lose its bloom. She was dressed in black. "What was the concert like?" asked Sir Herbert. "Oh, not bad at all. They gave a Brahms concerto and the fire music from the Walküre, and some Hungarian dances of Dvorak. I thought them rather showy." She turned to Ashenden. "I hope you haven't been bored all alone with my husband. What have you been talking about? Art and literature?" "No, it's raw material," said Ashenden. He took his leave.